hope you enjoyed the first part of our podcast with Cindy Blackstock. My name is Amisha.
And my name is Clara, and we would like to thank you for joining us for part two of our podcast series on the topic of Indigenous education in Canada. For those of you who are just joining us, this podcast was recorded by the McGill chapter of Journalists for Human Rights.
Our organization seeks to use grassroots journalism to bring awareness to human rights and governance issues in Canada and around the globe.
Amisha, I want to thank you for your interview with Cindy Blackstock. I really learned a lot on the discriminatory conditions that First Nations children are experiencing all throughout Canada.
Cindy's advocacy is crucial in bringing justice to the thousands of children who do not receive the services or education they deserve. If you haven't heard my discussion with Cindy, we recommend you check out part one of the podcast. While Cindy's work is certainly groundbreaking, she is not alone in standing up for the rights of Indigenous peoples in this country. Kenneth Deere is one of these activists, with whom Clara had a chance to speak. Could you tell us more about that conversation?
I met Kenneth Deere in one of my classes and was intrigued by his involvement with Indigenous education, especially with the Kahnawake Survival School. He is a highly prominent figure who promotes the rights of Indigenous people within his community, within Canada, and on the international level. Professor Deere has many titles, and just to name a few, he was a high school counselor, a principal, co-chairman of the National Indian Education Council in Canada, publisher and editor of the newspaper Eastern Door, speaker and active member at various United Nations working groups concerning Indigenous rights, and many more. Let's start with his experiences at Kahnawake Survival School, which is located just 20 kilometers from where we are.
I think one of the most rewarding when I was a high school counselor is to, right at the beginning, when I started in 1971, we had about 400 Mohawk students in a large school of 2,700, and it was overcrowded. And so you had our students rubbing shoulders in very close quarters, and there was friction. How our kids still hung on to their identity, that they were Mohawk. They wanted everybody to know that they were Mohawk. They tried hard to hang on to that. We managed to get some Mohawk language taught in the schools, you know, get more Native material into the library. It was good to see kids trying to finish high school. My job was to stop the dropout rate, you know. And although I didn't stop completely, we certainly slowed it down and we made children more comfortable. And so I thought that was very rewarding. The other part, creating our own high school, was one of the most amazing things. In the high school that we were in, they were trying to accommodate us. It still wasn't the same. The parents still felt we were being assimilated. So in 1978, they decided to pull their kids out of that high school, and we created our own high school overnight. First day of school, it was all over Bill 101. When Separatist government, Parti Québécois, took over in 76, they passed Bill 101, the language legislation, and in that bill, it said that you needed a license, you know, to get your education in English. And our kids, we were paying for our education. And we said that we don't need this, since we're paying for the services, we don't need this license. And we tried to negotiate with Quebec, but Quebec wouldn't change their mind. They said, no, you still have to get that. Plus the fact that people wanted our own high school came together. And the first day of school in September in 1978, Bill 101 wouldn't accommodate us, so we pulled all our kids out of that school. And so now we had, 300 students, but we had nothing. We had no school, no teachers, no books, but we had the students. So we said, that's the most important part of a high school. So we told the kids to go, this is a Wednesday. He says, go home, and on Monday we'll have a school for you. So everybody went home. And then in the 4 days, 5 days we had, we put together a high school. We appealed for volunteer teachers. We used all the community buildings, and we created classrooms, clusters, and we were following the Quebec curriculum as best we could. So we created a school in 5 days, and it was just amazing. And we with no money, I was watching this. I was so impressed with our community. All these parents were risking the education of their children based on a principle. So when October 1st came along, and we still had these kids, then the government knew we were serious and started negotiating funding, and then we started paying teachers and stuff like that and building temporary classrooms. And that was one of the most proudest moments I had of my community, to see the parents stand up for something and winning. It was amazing. On the negatives, the other part, of course, on the National Indian Education Council, we did a study around 85 about the situation of Indian education, with $3 million study. And of course, it was very clear that, Indian education was underfunded. Teachers were paid less. Our facilities needed to be improved. And so we were negotiating with the Minister of Indian Affairs, David Crombie, at the time. So we came very close to getting an agreement, but we just slipped away. So that was probably one of the more disappointing issues that we, in the late 80s, we could have done a lot for Indian education, but we were never able to do that. Further on the negative side, I think that we also have, working with the kids in a large high school, you know, we faced a lot of racism and also, a lack of understanding of our people. And it made it difficult for our kids to function in that school who felt that they were being treated differently. So, and they were, you know. And although I'm not saying that the teachers were deliberately racist, I think it's just this institutionalized racism where people just don't realize that what they're doing is racism because they don't believe that they are, you know. And because of the structure, because of the Indian Act and because of history, and there was just a clash of cultures. And so we saw a lot of that. And as a staff member, you could see it. And also you had the pressure and also the, you know, when you stood up for the kids, you know, you got a lot of pushback from the non-native staff. You know, you had that kind of stuff. So it was certainly my experience in the whole education system has been a lot of positive stuff and also enlightening on to see how institutionalized the racism is against our people.
I'm wondering, do you recall any particular cases or perhaps a particular student who really stood up against institutionalized racism?
Oh, geez, I don't want to, you know, there were some who would just, I mean, like, there were sit-ins. Our students were quite, you know, when they felt they were wronged, they let you know. They wouldn't take a back seat. And that's probably why, you know, some of them got in trouble because of that. And I remember there was a sit-in for something, I can't remember what the incident was. Some incident happened, and so the kids held a sit-in in the hallway, wouldn't go back to class. And when the principal showed up there, this young girl got up there and started talking to him in Mohawk, you know. And of course, the principal couldn't understand what it was, but it sounded bad. So she got suspended. Mm-hmm. And but she didn't say anything bad. She wasn't swearing. You can't swear in our language. Mm-hmm. So, but what she said was a word called snet duck, you know. And though she said it very harshly, all it means is chew gum. So she got suspended for telling the principal to chew gum.
Oh, yeah. In regards to your involvement in Indigenous education, I'm sure you had to work alongside the Canadian government. Did the government contribute significantly? What were some of the processes like in developing the programs?
Education was under the control of the federal government, you know, in the 70s and the 80s in my community, and before in my community. So everything that happened in education had to be approved by the Department of Indian Affairs. So there was a guy in Montreal who was just being involved in the contractual arrangements we had with Quebec to go to Quebec high schools and then also hiring and firing of teachers and stuff. And they also, Indian Affairs are the ones who hired the principals. And so they had a lot of influence. And during that time, 60s and 70s, you know, there was a big movement to take education back from Indian Affairs. Mm-hmm. And but still, we weren't in control of that. It wasn't the parents, you know, it wasn't the community. The Department of Indian Affairs was in charge of hiring and firing and mm-hmm. and supervision. And so our people got tired of that and went piece by piece. And one of the big breakthroughs originally was in 1967. The curriculum that we have in the day schools that we went to was the same curriculum you had in the residential schools. And the residential schools were designed to kill the Indian, save the man, you know. And so they learned nothing about their language or their culture. They were punished for speaking their language. And, well, that same curriculum was still the curriculum that we had in our school, in the day schools, even though I went home at night. But we had that same thing, you know, there was no language, no culture, nothing that resembled being a Mohawk in our schools. So our language was dying. And so we had some very industrious parents who decided to do something about that. And they started teaching Mohawk in our class in 67, 10 minutes a day. You know, from nothing, had to create the teaching materials and stuff like that, and they got paid like $20 or $40 a week, and so we got 20 minutes a day and then a half hour a day, you know, so that was a great breakthrough. In 1972 was an important year. In that year, in our in the Howard S. Billings High School in Chateauguay, where we had 400 Mohawk students, parents were not happy with the education system, so they pulled out 50 kids and created their own high school. And then they went to, these are traditional people at the Longhouse, and then they went to Ottawa and said, look, we're going to teach our kids our way, our culture. Same thing that was happening, there's a revolution in the United States, and it's the Little Red Schoolhouse and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. So they wanted to do the same thing here. And the federal government in Ottawa, amazingly, agreed, hey, he says, all right, we'll give you a per capita for each of the same, we'll give you the same amount that we would give the high school. So they gave them, for 50 students, to run their own school. And that caused such a real uproar inside Ottawa, inside the department. And so they created a new policy called Indian Control of Indian Education that came out the next year, 1973. And that was the policy that demonstrated to what happened, demonstrated to Ottawa that yes, we can control our own education. From 73 onwards, the federal government encouraged Native people to control their own schools. Mm-hmm. But the elementary schools were still federally run, and the teachers were quite comfortable with that. They were comfortable being federal employees, and so we had to work hard to take over control of that. So, but the teachers, some of them were reluctant because they were comfortable. They had a union, they had benefits, and they were afraid to lose, what kind of salary, what kind of pension they're going to have. They're going to lose seniority. Mm-hmm. So there was a process where we had to make them feel more comfortable. It took a while, 10 years after we created our own high school, before we took over the elementary schools. But that's the situation when you have a federal monolith to you have to move them out. The teachers stayed, mind you, and I think they're satisfied.
You mentioned institutionalized racism. One of the areas that Journalists for Human Rights is currently looking into are cases of discrimination in regards to funding for First Nations children, especially. In your experience, what are some of the most pressing cases of institutionalized racism in Canada, and how can we combat this issue of institutionalized racism?
The most fundamental institutionalized racism that you have is the whole idea of Crown land. That all the land in Canada that's not owned, it belongs to the Crown. That even on the Indian Reserve, the underlying title belongs to the Crown. And that's a fundamental dispossession and disempowerment of Indigenous people that goes all the way back to the age of explorers and also the Papal Bulls. Mm-hmm. That if the people in the new lands that you discover, if the people are not Christian, then you can claim it for your king. Mm-hmm. So that's why all the land here is called right now is Crown land, because it belongs to the British sovereign based on that. So the Supreme Court, even though we have all these terrific land claim issues and some good decisions, but the decisions are always fall back to the fact that the land really belongs to Canada. Even that as soon as Europeans landed, our sovereignty and the ownership of the land was compromised, which is a falsehood, which is not true. It's an invention. It's a legal invention. Because Canada does not want to face, and the court can't seem to face that we are the original owners of the land and we still own the land, and that Canada, and all of this is secondary to the fact that the original land is ours. Mm-hmm. But the court still won't recognize that. Even the strongest case, the most recent one in BC last year, the court still maintains that the underlying title still belongs to Canada. That's what I mean by the most serious kind of institutionalized racism. There's still the whole establishment of Canada is still based on the Papal Bulls and the Doctrine of Discovery and Christian dominance, and our rights are less than those.
So would you say that we would have to take a judicial approach to this?
I think it should be a political one. The courts are not fair. Mm-hmm. From our perspective, you have, like the Supreme Court, there are seven white people there making a decision on brown people. So there's no, it's not balanced. There's no Indigenous people on the Supreme Court, mm-hmm. And a court should be, if you want to talk about Canadians, a court that'll deal with Canadians and Indigenous people, then the court has to be more balanced. Yeah.
A lot of your work has focused significantly on Aboriginal students. I'm wondering, what's your perspective on how the Canadian government can tackle this issue in regards to other Canadian students across the nation?
We have to mainstream the issue of the rights of Indigenous people, the history, language. And we can't just have Native studies for Natives. We need Native studies that are across the board. Fortunately, I'm asked to co-teach in this course on Introduction to International Development, and I'm trying to inject some of that stuff into the course. And that's what should happen. We need to mainstream those articles. It depends on the teacher too, and also the quality of the information. I think we need to develop curriculum materials to help non-Indigenous people who are not familiar with it to cover it. But we also need more Indigenous teachers, professors, and Indigenous people developing curriculum, you know. And honest, Indigenous people, to me, don't have to lie or exaggerate. The truth is enough.